Thank you, Dan, but before you people have too much disappointment, may I assure you that I am not the speaker. Our speaker today is well known to all of you. He's a broadcaster among broadcasters, a former news reporter, an analyst, whose face and voice are as familiar to millions of Americans as are the face and voice of your next door neighbor. His memorable This Is London wartime radio broadcasts, including the German air blitz, the Allied invasion of France, and finally VE Day, earned him the accolade of the best known and the most influential American commentator of World War II. Later, his CBS programs, Hear It Now on radio, See It Now in Person to Person on television, added new luster not only to his network, but to his already well-deserved reputation. While he is no longer in the field of commercial radio or television, he still is a communicator, and the USIA already is showing evidence of his talented touch and inspirational leadership. That the esteem in which he is held by his fellow broadcasters is in no way diminished is perhaps best attested by the fact that he has been chosen as the recipient of this year's NAB Distinguished Service Award. It is a great honor and privilege to present to you at this time the Director of the United States Information Agency, the Honorable Edward R. Murrow. Mr. Murrow.
Mr. Chairman, sir, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I am grateful for such a gracious and generous introduction. I am just finishing my first year as a bureaucrat. When I first came, I went and sought the counsel of a man wise in the ways of Washington, and at the end of a very illuminating conversation, he said, "Well, Ed, it's a tough job you've taken on. There'll be times when you'll feel like a cat licking a grindstone." I confess that there have been times when I have felt in that fashion. You will appreciate that it is difficult for one accustomed to face only a microphone or a camera to face a live audience, because there is no case upon the record of a camera or a microphone dozing off, talking with its neighbor, or leaving the room. I am fully aware that a much talking bureaucrat is an ill-tuned instrument. I am further aware that you have a meeting scheduled for 2:30, and by long practice and conditioning, I am accustomed to start on time and stop on time, although what happens in between is not often of great consequence. I must confess that today I feel like an old friend returned to home. Broadcasting, as you have been told, was once my daily bread. In a sense, that is still true. But like many of you, I now run an organization, and sometimes in the waning of those mid-morning conferences, I am wont to think back to the early days in broadcasting and the saga of that now perhaps immortal cub reporter sent to cover his first big story. It was the Johnstown flood. The height of the tragedy was fast approaching. The paper held out its lead beyond press time, waiting for the cub's first reports, which finally arrived with the following cryptic message: "Chaos reigns. Nothing can be learned." It is, I hope, true of my present work that chaos reigns rarely, but that there is much to be learned. It is this, in part, that gives chilling dimension to much of what my agency does. The stake in our deliberations is not the success or failure of a good show, but the rise or fall of a free world interest, You translate your efforts into ratings gained, public acceptance, esteem, and respect, or dollars lost. We translate ours into persons persuaded or diplomacy lost. I must confess I was tempted to talk here today entirely about the work of this agency, an independent agency reporting directly to the President, budget $111.5 million, using all known instruments of communication in an effort to tell the American story abroad. However, I concluded that were I to do so, you would perhaps regard this as an unduly long commercial that profited you very little. Therefore, I thought to talk in the line of your discussion this morning as perhaps a personal editorial on the state of this small but troubled planet. There are great challenges afoot on this globe today. The Soviet has chosen to engage us in a type of fateful competition, testing whether free men still have the will to be free. There is, I suggest, a tendency in this country to drop the plumb line of measurement into our troubled diplomatic waters and calculate thereby the extent of our successes or failure. As of such a date, there are so many victories won, so many failures lost. Being a self-critical society, we chronicle the factors that some feel to go against us. A lingering suspicion in some new countries of Western colonialism and capitalism. Long-range intellectual leanings towards socialism. Envy in some countries of the purported economic progress achieved under communism, with little recognition of the fact that Western progress serves as the goal to which all people, including the Russians, aspire. A desire in some lands to maximize foreign aid from both camps, and a basic naivete about the realities of communism. I suggest we misread the signs. Some matters we consider negative may not in fact appear to be what they actually are. The counsel of despair for the cause of democracy is the counsel of the ignorant. It may be that we're a nation poorly prepared for our global role. But if poorly cast are we, then higher striving must there be. We are, I think you would agree, a pragmatic people. We test the validity of propositions by their practical results. This was a pioneer land, built by a pioneer people. To physical challenge, we responded with physical strength. I suggest we are set in our ways of thinking, and it is a way ill-conceived for the complexities of this day. Consider these considerations. From a history that has solved all problems, we assume that if a problem there be, then solution we will find. From a history that has known little frustration, we seek easy answers to difficult problems. From a history molded on the rightness of our national virtue, we seem self-assured that things will naturally go our way. We feel we are right and we are American, and the world will surely see the right of our American way if it is simply explained to them. We are, in a sense, only an explanation away from total victory. From a history that has simplified our troubles into terms of we and they, we assume there are only two sides to any question, and not 3 or 10 or 15 sides, as there are in NATO, or 20 sides, as there are in the Organization of American States, or 104 sides, as there are in the United Nations. From a history that has taught us the value of right and wrong, we leave no room for different descriptions of the same problem by different people. Thus, Khrushchev calls Berlin a bone in his throat and a cancer, while we term it a showcase of freedom and a symbol of hope. Perhaps what is symbol to us is cancer to him, and that is exactly why it is a problem. Thus do some of the enthrallments of our nationhood poorly cast us for the role we must now play, a role we did not seek. We're a good people. We are loath to use the whip, the knout, the fist, and its force. It may well be that while we grew up as a land, the world of our growth changed beyond all dimension. Difficult problems will only surrender to difficult solutions. Some problems may have no immediate solution at all. Our conception of right and wrong may not be right for the wrongs of others. The issues of the world are multi-sided and many varied. They may not all be settled in our favor. As George Bernard Shaw said, "Do you think the laws of God will be suspended in favor of this country because you were born in it?" And it was the counsel of Abraham Lincoln that read, "We must disenthrall ourselves." The fate of this land and this people will be decided, I suggest, by what we do on three fronts. The way we conduct ourselves here at home. The way we conduct ourselves confronting the communist foe. The way we conduct ourselves in the vast arena of marginal lands with multiplying people. Our conduct at home is a matter of our common concern. Our conduct regarding the Soviets is a matter of our common defense. Our conduct regarding the new nations is a matter of our common effort. How we regard them all in concert is a matter of our common destiny. I, for one, would not wish to prejudge the issue in any area. But in this world of discomfiture, where all of us live on the narrow margin between happiness and Holocaust, it is well that we try to assess our position. Communism came to power in Russia due to World War I. Communism came to power in China due to World War II. It has never come to power in any nation not disrupted by war, by civil war, or by both. It has never come to power but by the force of military might in being, in place, and without opposition. It has succeeded as a scavenger. It has failed as a leader. The Communist Party of the Soviet Union is challenged both within and without its own world. These years have seen rebellion in Budapest, uprisings in Poland, revolts in East Germany, repression throughout the satellite empire. There is a wall in Berlin, damming the flood tide of fleeing humanity. There is dissension in Peking and Tirana, to add to that of Belgrade. Communist parties in Europe have shrunk drastically. The Soviet Union as a nation is permanent come to the councils of world concern. But for the last decade, its foreign policy has failed to expand its control. It relies on the weapons of subversion, propaganda, infiltration, brute terror, and naked force. But it has conspicuously failed. It has been frustrated by the United States, by its allies, by the United Nations, by nations of other passions, and perhaps most of all, by the determination that where men have the will to be free, they will be free. The catalog of Soviet difficulties is an impressive one. Their unity with China is increasingly in question. Communist parties throughout the world are doing less business. There has been little sale on their ideology. Neutrals will not be bought with guns and dams. Capitalism's amazing vigor runs counter to their dogma. The alliance has not groaned, but has grown. Western Europe rises to new union. The United Nations is slowly acquiring a capacity for world responsibility. And in the words of Harlan Cleveland, the hard line boys in the Kremlin should be muttering about people who are soft on capitalism. This land can manage the difficult and demanding task of free alliance with other sovereign nations. This the Soviet Union cannot do. This land can cooperate and accommodate and even compromise in the handling of global problems. This the Soviet seems unwilling to do. This land can live with the Charter of the United Nations. This the Soviet cannot do. This land can identify its legitimate national hopes with the national hopes of other nations, and this the Soviet cannot do. Theirs is the way of orthodoxy. Theirs is the way of creed without deviation, the dogma without dissent, the conformity to which all must adhere. If theirs be the world of coercion, then ours is the world of free choice. To a globe now fumbling with newfound freedoms, to lands now groping for their own place in the constellation of nations, this land, this people, has much to offer. A communist, I suggest, cannot look upon the future with sanguine confidence. But this struggle is now not near ended. It is not likely to be resolved quickly, easily, cleanly, or simply. If gains we have garnered, there are still tasks to be tried. And you, ladies and gentlemen, I venture to suggest, can share in this endeavor. I have suggested the three arenas where our fortunes lie: at home, against the Soviets, and in the new lands. We must all, of course, join in the unfinished task of finishing the molding of our own land. This country was founded upon belief in great ideals. It is to the zealots that we owe our heritage, our belief in education, in social justice, in the living wage, in freedom of speech with the right of dissent, and the critique of conformity, in all the importance of all men as equal and kindred souls. But these are subjects unknown in some places and unwanted in others. There are abroad on this planet great masses of people totally insulated from this country and what it believes only by the pall of their ignorance. It is the job of my agency to try and reach these people. And reach them we will try. But the U.S. Information Agency can only be as effective in reaching men's minds as the society it serves. Desirable or not, we shall reflect what we are. If we would have the world think better of us, then we must better ourselves. I would like to suggest that without speaking of running my agency, this has in fact been a speech of how my agency runs, because it can run in no other way. For the USIA is the new dimension of the new diplomacy. We occupy the battle line that engages this entire land. We seek to explain this country and all it does. Our goal is the minds of men, but the war we wage is not to capture men's minds. It is a war to free them. And I would suggest in all seriousness that how we conduct ourselves in this country, the type of society we fashion, the expansion of political, social, economic equality, decency, and justice may have much more to do with our case abroad, may be much more effective than the dollars we send abroad. The way of free men, as we all know, is the way of difficulty. If all may think, then all must be explained. If each may dissent, then each must be convinced. We in the agency must talk of full stomachs to those who have known only hunger. We must speak of comfortable lives to those who have known only toil. We must talk of the future and its dream to those who have known only the past and its despair. And we must speak of freedom to men who have known only subjection. We must tell unfree men that freedom, in some places, may be a sometime thing. And to those newly free, we must caution against having left one form of control only to deliver themselves to a new and heavier yoke. It is difficult and complex, this concept of freedom. But it is priceless, this dream we offer to share. And share it we must. And we shall know that in laboring for our children and ourselves, we labor in fact for all mankind. And all mankind will be in our debt if we but realize that our heritage is the heritage of hope. For with our hopes go the fate of free men everywhere.
Ed Morrow, as fellow broadcasters, we've welcomed having you back with us for this brief interlude. The succinct recommendations that you have made to us of what we can do have been in keeping with the objectives of this conference, and you've made us mindful, too, of the importance of broadcasting around the world. We thank you very much for being with us. This luncheon...